Hello and welcome to the Grand Exotic Guardian Film Show. The concierge will take your bags, the minibar is free, and the penthouse suite commands an unparalleled view of this week's cinema attractions. Please consider yourself officially checked in. Coming up on this week's show, the Greek and Persian forces unleash the dogs of war and the cats of thunder in the comic book action romp 300, Rise of an Empire. Director Kirby Dick tackles the topic of sexual assault in the military in his harrowing documentary, The Invisible War. And we'll be casting our eye back over the biggest, starriest, and most prestigious film awards on the calendar. We refer, of course, to the Guardian Film Awards. It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet this week. We begin, though, with the Grand Budapest Hotel, the eighth feature from the mercurial writer-director Wes Anderson. It's a tale of murder, intrigue, and succulent pastries. And it looks like this.
Excuse me?
Uh-huh.
The police are here. They asked for you.
Tell them I'll be right down.
Okay.
Have you ever been questioned by the authorities?
Yes, on one occasion.
What?
Ralph Fiennes stars as the imperiled Monsieur Gustave in the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is nominally set in the Middle European mountains, but largely resides in the mind of Wes Anderson. It's a lovely confection, crisply arranged and drizzled with honeyed performances from the likes of Tilda Swinton, Willem Dafoe and Adrian Brody.
How may we serve you, gentlemen?
Inspector Henkel.
By order of the Commissioner of Police, Zeebrugge Province, I hereby place you under arrest for the murder of Madame Celine Villeneuve de Goff and Taxis.
I knew there was something fishy. We never got the cause of death. She's been murdered. And you think I did it.
Hey! Joining me now at reception is Peter Bradshaw and Catherine Shaud. Peter, I've slightly fallen out of love with Wes Anderson over recent years, having adored him, but I'm kind of right back in infatuation mode here.
Yes, I've fallen shatteringly back in love with the great man myself. I fell out of like with him over the Darjeeling Limited, which I didn't care for. I thought it kind of went wrong. The kind of sweetness and gentleness of Anderson's address to his audience seemed to have deserted him in that movie. But I love Fantastic Mr. Fox, and I love this. There's something absolutely sublime about it, and it's so authorial. I mean, there isn't anyone who deserves to be called an auteur really more than Wes Anderson. He has that extraordinary eccentricity. I tend to think of him in the same breath of as Michel Gondry and Charlie Kaufman and all these people, and I can't remember, Spike Jones to some extent. But nobody looks more as if he has literally created a film all on his own.
Every single frame.
As if he's literally like some very, very talented but difficult 14-year-old boy who spent the last 18 months in his bedroom and has come out with this film for us. And it's extraordinary. There's a wonderful scene in it where the lifer prisoner, played by Harvey Keitel, draws a map of the escape route. And Gustav, played by Ralph Fiennes, says, "That's amazing. Look at the line on that." And it's exactly how we feel with this film. Yeah. Look at the beautiful line drawing you've created there. That's marvellous. And it is. It's absolutely beguiling. I really loved it.
You could say that there's too much control. There's a kind of clockwork precision, but there's a sort of warmth and even a sadness to this film, isn't there?
I think for me, what puts it apart from his other less successful, live action things, is that the central character has immense charm and isn't a screw up. Most of them, they're sort of they're screwed up and they're quirky in an irritating way.
And they're privileged.
And they're privileged. Whereas Monsieur Gustave is genuinely charming, genuinely funny.
Yeah.
It's a rare opportunity to see Ralph Fiennes being actually funny.
I didn't know he could do that.
Really funny. And I think for me that's what carries it through, is that you're not irritated by the character. There's no arc that they need to perform. There's just charm, absolute charm and precision. And fastidiousness in the same way as Wes Anderson is fastidious in his directing style. And so it doesn't feel wrong that it's exactly put together like that. It feels like an extension of its leading man's personality, which is lovely.
It's based on the writing of Stefan Zweig.
Yes.
But it also reminded me of Joseph Roth novels and Nabokov and people like that.
Yes.
Do you think that this is a kind of key underpinning? This gives him a kind of weight that maybe he hadn't had before?
I'm not sure. It's certainly the comparison with Zweig is something he takes very seriously. As I understand it, he has given his name to a new edition of a kind of selection of Zweig's prose, an edited version of some translation of Zweig's prose. It reminded me more of Thomas Mann's Confessions of Felix Krull, which is very like this, the kind of world of chancers and weirdos and invalids and white Russians, all of whom are in these sanatoriums and hotel spas. All of them have a story to tell.
Yeah.
If you sat them down and took a cup of tea with them, they would have some incredible story to tell of the old world that began to be swept away between the wars. And again, it's very unusual. Wes Anderson, quite unusually for an American director, has really kind of sensitively tuned into that, but given his own absolutely unique kind of gloss on it. Other people said, it's like Ernst Lubitsch and of course Hitchcock, The Lady Vanishes, and he's sort of absorbed that as well. So yes, I mean, I think he has really absorbed that literary quality and somehow earned it from the word go. I mean, usually if you have scenes of people talking about some building and saying, I loved the old place, I was entranced, but I loved it, I would think, come on, let's see whether we love it or not. Give me a few minutes here. But I kind of loved it as well. The minute I came in, it's as if he built it. It was like the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. Yeah. I just thought, my God, this is...
But I want to stay
but
here.
But I want
I didn't
to stay
want to stay in the Overlook.
No, but I thought it was... Clearly, I think he is inspired a little bit by the Overlook, especially the colossal lobby area with its sort of galleried kind of staircases. It clearly is, I think, inspired a little bit by Kubrick, their Kubrickian ambition and madness to have this entire thing looking as if it's been built. As I understand it, it didn't have to be built in the same way that the Overlook had to be built, but all the interiors had to be built. But it's incredible. The star of the movie really is the hotel in some ways, even though a lot of the action doesn't take place in the hotel. But what a trick to have brought off to make that preposterous building charming as well.
Catherine, where does it rank with the other Wes Anderson films?
For me, it's up there with Tenenbaums. I think it's terrific. And it's funny that it's got all this incredible precision and sort of great sympathy with really quite high-tone European literature and so on. And yet, it's just very funny as well. Mm. That's the other thing about it. It's very funny. There's a lot of simple gags that are funny, like William Dafoe chucking Jeff Goldblum's cat out the window. Mm. It really just delivers on those levels. It's also quite profane, for all its precision. It's sort of shockingly profane. And that is.
And the profanity
something.
Is almost like they go off like bombs amidst the very kind of tight etiquette of the rest of it.
I love that. I love that about it. And it's sort of, that's something you didn't even have in Tenenbaums, really. And for all its sort of precision, it's more relaxed than Tenenbaums. It's more larky. It's more at ease with itself. I think, is it better than Tenenbaums? I don't know. But
for me, I actually... I can't think of one I like better right now. I think it's up there with Tenenbaums.
Rushmore? What,
I think I like it better than Rushmore.
Really? Well.
It's more sort of finished and more distinct in the Rush. Rushmore and Bottle Rocket, they are the more obviously autobiographical. They're the more loose-limbed phase, I suppose, of Anderson's early career. But this has a kind of, I don't know, it's sort of complete and entire
maturity.
Of itself, has a sort of maturity and a kind of force and technique, which I'm kind of in awe of. And as I say, how extraordinary that Ralph Fiennes has loosened up so much. I say, I talk about being uptight and clenched and technique-y, but Ralph Fiennes genuinely funny, especially those things where he has to, in such a broad comedy way, run away from the camera. He has to panic and run away, and Anderson keeps the shot steady, and he has to run away like a little figure, away and up the stairs. And it's very broad. It's real Marx Brothers.
With his back very straight.
It's Marx Brothers stuff. It really is the Marx Brothers. And yet, who would have thought Fiennes could have carried that? But he does.
Who are you?
I'm Zero, sir. The new lobby boy.
Zero, you say?
Yes, sir.
Well, I've never heard of you, never laid eyes on you. Who hired you?
Mr. Mosher, sir.
Mr. Mosher?
Yes, Monsieur Gustave.
Am I to understand you've surreptitiously hired this young man in the position of a lobby boy?
He's been engaged for a trial period, pending your approval, of course.
Perhaps, yes. Thank you, Mr. Mosher.
You're most welcome, Monsieur Gustave.
You're now going to be officially interviewed.
Should I go and light the candle first, sir?
What? No. Experience.
Hotel Kinski, kitchen boy, 6 months. Hotel Berlitz, mop and broom boy, 3 months. Before that, I was a skillet scrubber.
Experience zero.
That's Ralph Fiennes up to his neck in trouble in the Grand Budapest Hotel. Moving on now, we come to The Invisible War, a forensic crusading documentary about what's been described as the occupational hazard of life in the armed forces. It's produced by Amy Ziering and directed by Kirby Dick.
I joined the military halfway through my senior year of high school, wanting to serve my country.
The Coast Guard said that they could get me in within a month, so shipped me off.
I loved that I could keep up with the guys and work as hard as they did.
The professionalism, the camaraderie.
Getting out there and giving it my all.
That's what I chose to do.
Everything changed the day that I was raped.
It is estimated that 500,000 service women and men have been sexually assaulted in the US Armed Forces, although the perpetrators are rarely brought to justice. The Invisible War spotlights a vast systemic cover-up in which the victims are blamed for reporting the crime. Kirby Dick's compelling documentary stages a trial of its own.
They gave him Military Professional of the Year award during the rape investigation.
It was a laughing matter.
He says, "You're the third girl to report rape this week. You guys, like, all in cahoots? You think this is a game?"
Catherine, Kirby Dick has said that he was shocked on starting to make this film, that other people haven't made this film before him. It is this sort of terrible untold story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those things that when you start to think about it, you think, well, of course that would be the case, wouldn't it? That would be the dreadful case. It's like the there was that new book recently about how priests used to use the confession box to groom young boys, and you sort of think, oh, well, of course they did, actually, of course. Obviously, they would have. It's dreadful. It's not something I'd ever thought about, but clearly it's an absolutely enormous, dreadful problem. And I was pleased to have my eyes open to it in such a sensitive way. It felt a little bit US TV kind of, you know, the music was very manipulative and it was a bit, I didn't feel you needed that treatment. And I was a bit surprised because the this film is not yet rated was quite sort of sparky and lively and unconventional. Mm. This is a very, very conventional treatment. However, with subject matter like this, perhaps that's a good plan. Don't go too quirky.
Harrowing as hell, isn't it?
I found it very harrowing. I found it really eye-opening as well, particularly Kirby Dick's discussion of the extraordinary poster campaign that the US Army devised as a response to the complaints. This extraordinary poster campaign called "Ask Her When She's Sober." And it's only when you have to think about this and you realise that what they're saying is, guys, if you're dating these women, please wait till they're sober, because if you do it when they're drunk, they're just going to cry rape and we're going to have a huge bureaucratic headache on our hand. That was their response, that it's their fault.
Absolutely.
It's this extraordinary victim-blaming campaign. It's gasp-inducing. The question is, what of those of us who are not US citizens, who are, as it were, UK civilians, what do we take from this? And what I think we take from this is, you know, the US Army is in the front line, or it has been since 9/11, of America's place in the world. It used to be things like, you know, Hollywood, and then increasingly it was the Army. The US military is what the Americans sent into the world to defend its prestige and defend its homeland, reputation, and its security. And this military is massively dysfunctional.
Yeah.
And Kirby Dick is entitled to ask, how will this dysfunction affect its relation with foreign civilian populations? Mm. He's entitled to ask that, I think.
And also that it just can't police itself. Yeah. It can't be trusted to actually run its own house.
It's not like internal affairs with the police. It isn't like that. You have to complain, in the first instance at any rate, to your commanding officer. Mm. And your commanding officer not only may well be acquainted with the assailant, he may have made a professional investment in the assailant's career, he may be the assailant himself. And you suddenly realise, well, the US military, can it be basically just a playground for rapists? Is that the kind of calibre of males that they are attracting? Mm.
It shines a light on the culture within the military as well, in terms of they talk about it being somehow even worse if it happens in the military because of that culture of brotherly, sisterly kind of unity. That was a little interesting on that, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, they also say, it was interesting stats about to what extent sexual assault is a sort of repeat offence, and you know, somebody in the career of a rapist, they're likely to have attacked about 300 people, and so it's not just a military thing because there aren't that many women in the military. You know, they're gonna, when they're discharged, it's not gonna go well. I thought that was all extremely interesting because it's, you know, with the sort of thing you can sort of think, oh, it's, you know, it's the army, I don't know about the army, and it's American army, I don't know even anything about that, but you know, it's it sort of proves the lie of thinking like that.
We're also talking about a film that we're saying is necessary and worthy and galvanising in a way, but is it a film that people are going to go and see? That's always the problem with these kind of documentaries, I guess.
I don't think it is, really, but then, I mean, you think something like The Act of Killing, which we're all endlessly saying people should go and see it. You know, what's the purpose of any documentary? Is it for education? Is it for entertainment? This does both to the extent that you can be entertained by finding out about something and stirred. I mean, should people... I mean, it's not a great Friday night out. It's not a great date movie. But it's certainly a very... very well made and good film.
About 500,000 women have now been sexually assaulted in the US military.
Civilians see it as being a military problem.
Anybody can be a victim of sexual assault.
Rapists are repetitive criminals.
Why would they stop?
They go on to literally prey on women and men, girls and boys in our neighborhoods back home.
It's very difficult to do a story on the most powerful institution in the world.
The Department of Defense has a history of covering up sexual offense problems. I don't know who you think elected you to defy the Congress of the United States. What is it you're trying to hide?
Kirby Dix, searing, heartfelt, The Invisible War. Next up, and at the risk of getting whiplash, it's 300, and try as I might, I can't think of any remotely tasteful link between these two pictures. Far safer to just pause and run the clip instead.
The swords clash, the blood sprays, and the sweat glistens on the naked torsos. It's 300, Rise of an Empire, where Eva Green's Persian queen is preparing to crush and destroy, and possibly kill, the Greek forces led by Sullivan Stapleton. Peter, did the sight of semi-naked buff men fighting get you shaken or stirred?
Usually it does, usually. I can't really think of any film to compare this to except perhaps Derek Jarman's Sebastian. We all do gags about how gay it is, but to be fair to these films, to be fair, that is what they are about. They're interestingly
very... Yeah, it's not unintentional.
No, it's not unintentional, which is what makes me think, golly, who are these films candidly aimed at, because it's all about, the last one was all about Spartans' disapproval of the Greeks espousing boy love. I mean, it's absolutely on the table. And this too has a kind of gay thing when Themistocles comes to ask for Queen Gorgo's help in uniting Greece, including Sparta, in the battle against the Persian naval forces. She's absolutely contemptuous of him and of them and of the rest of the Greeks, pretty avowedly because of their practices. She says something like, well, you've come a long way to stroke your cock while you watch real men train. So I think, well, it's all very well for us...
pitch right at the audience. Yeah.
So it's all very well for us to sort of make jokes about how, ooh, misses, how gay it all is. But interestingly, it is very, very candid about this. So I don't quite know what to think. It's very, very tiresome now. I quite like the first one because it was very unusual. It's certainly, it's not every day you get a film about the Battle of Thermopylae or any film set in 480 BC. And it's certainly distinctive and unusual. But It's directed in its absolutely leaden and relentless way. There is absolutely no light and shade. Not only in the, just the visual palette of the screen has all this sort of dull metallic grey, blue, browns. It's very muddy and difficult to watch. And the way in which the actors are directed is just dreary. And he has this habit of when anybody gets their head cut off or their limbs cut off, which happens all the time, it switches down to slow-mo so we can see the blood splurging across the screen. Oy vey. I mean, it's just horrible.
Eva Green is in the film, and she's having rather a sort of skittish career, isn't she?
She is. She's certainly unusual. She's very, very eccentric in this film. I mean, she doesn't look like the normal babe at all, which is quite good in a way. She looks like she isn't an actor at all. She looks like quite a talented writer who's been persuaded to be an actor, which is quite good. I mean, I think she is very I've compared her in the past to Sarah Miles because she is quite eccentric in a way, her address. She's, you know, she's a beautiful woman, and she's not a bad actor by any means, but she is quite, there's something quite off kilter about her performance.
Catherine, we were talking about who's going to go and see The Invisible War, but you haven't seen this. So significantly, you chose to see The Invisible War, but not this. Why isn't this lighting your fire?
Well, it sort of is now. Now you're talking about it. I mean, I couldn't think of anything worse before, but now, you know, it shows the power of this show, I suppose. I'm now quite persuaded.
You offered freedom without consequence or responsibility.
Are you accepting my offer?
My answer is still no.
The muscles and the tussles in 300, Rise of an Empire. And now, finally, from one bullish piece of world domination to another, in the immediate wake of the Oscars, the inaugural Guardian Film Awards rode into battle to have its final say on this year's crop of contenders. Catherine, as the main organiser of this event, what was the feeling about why we need another awards in this season?
I suppose the idea was both to sort of reflect Guardian values in the categories. So we wanted it to be inclusive. We wanted all the categories open to fact and fiction and foreign language, because, I mean, it's something like the Oscars, you sort of think, really, Paolo Sorrentino is not up for Best Director. It's not one of the best directed films of this year. And so, so all our categories were open to all everything. And also Guardian style is to call everyone an actor, regardless of gender. So we wanted to reflect that a bit. We wanted to have a bit of fun. We wanted to engage with the awards process in a way that felt a bit more like it reflected people's experience of cinema going. And also to give the readers a say. So they had a casting vote and they decided the shortlist from the long list and things like that. So it's been an experiment. But, I mean, a very interesting one.
Peter, you've been a jury member at the Cannes Film Festival. How did this compare in terms of glamour?
I think it compared very well in terms of glamour. It was a wonderful judging experience, a great lunch that we had, a very uproarious, very garrulous, terrifically enjoyable and stimulating. Cannes is very sort of Mandarin. We weren't at all like that. I found it that the judging process entered precisely into the spirit that Catherine has described. It's open, it's good-humoured and good-natured. It's trying to be inclusive and to be a little less snooty and highbrow and bring in more of the actual kind of experience of movie-going and talking about movies.
With the Guardian Film Awards, we wanted to put our readers at the heart of them, and we wanted to approach the awards process from the perspective of filmgoers. We wanted to talk about films in the way that people talk about them when they've gone to see them. They discuss things like best scene, best line.
I love being part of the Guardian Film Awards. What I love about it is the best film includes
films in a foreign language, so it's not separated. It's just like, right, I'm going to the cinema. What is the one film, the best film of the year?
I really hope that these awards act as an antidote as opposed to an addition to the already very, very crowded movie awards calendar.
That's the hanging judges, Catherine Short, Peter Bradshaw, Adam Curtis, Claudia Winkleman, Alan Rusbridger, and Casper Llewellyn Smith having their say on this year's inaugural Guardian Film Awards. And that's it from me. Please do drop in again and see us sometime soon. We booked you in same time next week.